Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. This is the last in our series of podcasts from the Hoover Institution's October 25th Media Colloquium at Stanford University. In this final session, Jack Goldsmith addresses the group of distinguished journalists about the changing legal norms of national security journalism, and the journalists push back. It's a sometimes funny, often combative, and highly informative session in which Jack and the reporters discuss when and whether journalists and sources should be prosecuted for publication of national security secrets and why journalists never actually are. They also discuss the merits and risks of leaks and some of the underlying powers the government is engaged in under the Obama administration.
The title of my session is Secrecy, Accountability, and the Constitution, and I'm going to try to talk about something that touches on all three of those words. And what I'm going to say has been touched upon in the conversation already. I'll try to put it in a little bit different frame. I want to start off by saying that there's no one in this room who's not a journalist, who admires national security journalism more than I do, who I'm friends, I consider myself close acquaintances with many of you. I've talked to many of you. I admire your work, and I've defended journalism and the role of national security journalists since 9/11 robustly. But I just want to say that you guys are really thin-skinned, and this is surprising to me because you cover institutions.
What the hell do you mean by that?
I love you, but you need to relax a little bit, not be so thin-skinned. You cover institutions, and you know that institutions that you cover have a mix of a self-serving aspect and a principled goal, and they get mixed up. People shade the truth. Sometimes they make mistakes, and you know how people respond when they're criticized. And you kind of think that they're thin-skinned and they overreact, and you're just doing your job. But the same is true of you. You have a combination of motivated by principle and self-serving. You make mistakes, and I just think that when people say things to you, you should just not be so defensive about it. That's all. Okay. And I mean that with affection. I'm serious. Okay. So with that in mind, so I'm going to talk about what I think are two constitutional changes in the last 12 years. And by constitutional changes, I mean what lawyers call little c constitution. And that's not what the words of the document say, or necessarily what the Supreme Court says, but really the real law that makes the government work, the set of kind of deep assumptions and the practices of the government and the assumptions and understandings that surround those practices and the inherent limitations on governmental practices. And the sources of the little c constitution can include judicial decisions and executive branch lawyers advising and political pushback and what the people think and what journalists write. I'm going to suggest that in the last dozen years, we've seen two important changes at that level that I don't think has been sufficiently appreciated. One involves checks and balances. The other involves the press and openness. The first, I think, will be, well, maybe they're both familiar. So we're familiar with how different the war we've been in since 9/11 is. And in the sense that it's against non-state actors, it's geographically dispersed, the enemy's not a state, the enemy finds itself in the state of sometimes our allies. It's a war that has no apparent end. It's a war that keeps morphing. It's a war that is intelligence-driven primarily, and that means that it is a war that involves stealth, both in collection and targeting and other aspects. And it's a war that has seen the size of the permanent intelligence bureaucracy and the permanent secrecy bureaucracy grow like never before. So I think those are some of the characteristics of the war since 9/11, and I think there have been two constitutional changes as a result of that. And basically, war, as we all know, empowers the president, gives the president a lot more power than he would normally have in peacetime. And the Constitution actually contemplated a shift, kind of a jurisdictional shift from peace to war. And during war, which would be limited, the president would have more powers, and then we'd go back to peacetime, and things would be back on a normal footing. And one of the problems is that this war is not going to end anytime soon. It's more permanent. It involves a permanent military footing and a permanent large intelligence footing. So one of the things that I think is insufficiently appreciated, and I think this was kind of on display earlier in the morning when we were talking about how powerful the president was, is how deeply constrained the president is also. There's this sense that, I sense that many of you think that President Obama, that law doesn't matter very much, and Obama can do whatever he wants, and these speeches, they're just speeches, and they're just rationalizing what he wants to do, and there's no constraint on the president. I think that's wrong, and I'm going to briefly just tick off some boxes because some of these points will be obvious. I want to get to the FISA stuff. But there's a lot of constraint inside the executive branch that's very hard for you to see and very hard for me to prove, and it has to do with lots of different veto points that lead you don't see very often in the public. When you're covering the press coverage, you don't see the things the government doesn't do because it's decided that it's unlawful or a bad idea. You see what it does, and then you see it justify what it does. In fact, there's a lot of restraint at the level of lawyers and policymakers and inspectors general. Fear about things being exposed to the press leads to constraint. There's a lot of a constraint inside the executive branch. Congress said, but I'm not going to talk about that because I can't convince you of that because it's secret. Congress has, in this war, been much more involved in checking the presidency than in any war in our history, I believe. This is not well known. Congress is thought to be feckless. In fact, Congress has been heavily involved in regulating every aspect of what the commander-in-chief does. Now, let me just say accountability. I'm going to talk about accountability. Accountability is a term I think gets misused. All accountability means, in the sense that I'm going to use it, and in the sense in which the Constitution talks about it, is that, let's just say, how is the executive accountable? All it means is that the executive branch has to account for itself to another institution, be it Congress or the courts or the press or the people. And those institutions have a chance to know what the president's doing, to assess what it's doing, and to weigh in with whatever power it has to push back if it wants to or to approve if it wants to. In that sense, Congress has been much more involved in holding the president accountable since 9/11 than I think in any other war. It basically ended the interrogation program in 2005 with large majorities in Congress. With the Detainee Treatment Act, the passage of the Detainee Treatment Act, it basically stopped the high-level interrogation program. That was something Congress did. Congress regulates military commissions, and for the first time in our history, this is something that's always been under the purview of the executive branch. Now it's under Congress's control, and Congress, in a very fine-grained way, in a way the president didn't want, now tells us what military commissions looks like. Congress regulates detention and trials in a way they never have before. And Congress is also, in a very unprecedented way, not pushing back on a president trying to be more aggressive, but pushing back on a president a different way. Congress has never before been involved in limiting a president's ability to control trials in America, to control the transfer and release of detainees. These are all things of Congress holding the president accountable, not allowing the president to do something he thinks is important because it has a different view. Courts have been much more heavily involved in this conflict than ever before. They've been involved heavily in detention, in regulating and justifying detention. Military commissions, struck down Bush's military commissions, early commission, led to a new commission with a quite different commission. They've been involved even in targeting. There's a decision on targeting, and everyone thinks, well, the court punted because it said it didn't have jurisdiction. But that was the first time that the president's targeting decisions in that way have ever been questioned in a court, and the court took the argument seriously and interpreted the Constitution to say it's none of our business. That's still a form of accountability. The Constitution was interpreted, and the court said it was the president's job, not ours. The most interesting and important type of accountability is the stuff that's going on in surveillance. And here, when I look at the Snowden disclosures about 702 and, am I getting the numbers wrong? 702 and 215, I think, yeah. The metadata program and the program that was called or about PRISM, it's really an extraordinary story about basically what the government's done in the last 10 years in the intelligence world, and especially in surveillance. It has tried, in stark contrast to what the Bush administration was doing in the first four or five years, it's tried to replicate checks and balances in a very serious way, in secret, to recognize the fact that we've got these important intelligence goals that need to be furthered, and that there's a problem with the president doing all these things on his own in secret on a permanent basis, and that a lot of this stuff is potentially very controversial, especially as it applies to U.S. citizens. So they've developed a regime where Congress is much more involved than ever in defining what the president can and can't do, in which the court, the FISA court, is much more involved in knowing what the president can do and in pushing back against the president, and in which inside the executive branch there are extraordinary restraints. So when I see the Snowden revelations and when people see, oh, that there was this compliance problem and that compliance problem, and the court, this used to be the story that the court was a rubber stamp, and now it seems like the court is not such a rubber stamp. In fact, it was pushing back much more than we thought. And it turns out that the National Security Agency was actually scrupulously figuring out when things were going right and wrong and reporting that to the Justice Department and to the court. And whatever you think about the actual, what they were doing, the system was operating in a robust way, in a robust form of accountability in private, with the executive branch having to explain itself and justify itself to the executive branch. Amy's charts showed a drop in public hearings before the intelligence committees, but an increase in hearings in private, and that's the compromise we've made. We're doing a lot more stuff that can't be talked about in public for better or for worse, or at least the government thinks can't be talked about for better or for worse. But the Congress is actually, the CISI and the House intelligence committees are much more involved, and they know much more in much more intimate detail than ever about what the executive branch is doing than ever before. And that was, explains the rise in private and secret hearings. So I would say that we've developed a pretty remarkable and novel system of getting all the branches in government in wartime involved in holding the president accountable in wartime, including in secret, in a just entirely unprecedented way. There were, to say unprecedented, there were glimmers of this. There have been throughout American history. This continued a trend, but it's grown enormously. And so one important constitutional change, little c constitutional change, is just the extent to which law and accountability and checks and balances have been brought to bear on the president during wartime. Now, just before I move on to secrecy, I'll just say sometimes that's good for what the president's doing and sometimes it's bad. In fact, most of this stuff, I think, has made the president more powerful, made it easier for him to do what he wants to do. The best example, I think, the FISA amendments, you might think this is true of detention, getting the courts involved basically diffused the issue of Gitmo from a political perspective, largely diffused it, because the courts basically legitimated Bush's and Obama's detentions. I also think that the FISA court, the FISA Amendments Act in 2008, which gave the court and the Congress and these internal actors and the executive branch more control over what's going on, also enabled the president to do a lot more than he could have done without their input. So there's a lot more collection going on of various sorts after the FISA Amendments Act. And this is actually the effect of getting the other branches involved. It actually often allows the president to do more. And I'll also say that I think that one reason why there wasn't more of an outcry over the domestic collection aspects that have been disclosed by Snowden is precisely because, just explaining, you know, why I'm surprised there hasn't been more of an outcry, I think it's in large part because all these branches did approve it. There are these courts. Imagine the reaction if this was going on and no one, if Congress was in the dark, if it was a secret inside the executive branch, if the courts had not approved it, if Congress had not reapproved the program in 2012, with at least the possibility of knowing what's going on, the whole public attitude would have been different. So I think that these checks have actually had a more important legitimating impact, and I think that they will be seen to have one more in the future when it really becomes time to decide whether to reauthorize it or not. And I expect, I could be wrong, that it will mostly be reapproved. Okay, so that's one constitutional change, I think. The second, I think, has to do with the relationship between the press and the government and the government's ability to keep secrets. So Leonard Downey Jr., the former executive editor of the Post, a few weeks ago had a woe is me report about what a horrible time the press was having because the government was being so secretive. And David Sanger said it was the most closed, control-freak administration I've ever covered, which may be true. The basic thrust of the story was it was harder and harder for reporters to get at their sources, especially in the national security world, because the sources were really afraid because there have been 6 leak prosecutions. And the tone of the 25-page report was that this is just making our job so hard, and it's unprecedented, And it's just, it's a terrible thing. And that's why the report was written. And I was laughing out loud as I was reading the report. And I was laughing out loud watching all these reporters being quoted. Scott was one of them. Scott said this is a big problem. He was talking about his inability to, how afraid his sources were. And I was just laughing because Scott regularly reports classified information. And I'm pretty sure at a much greater rate now and in the last, I don't know how many years, than before 9/11. And it is true. I think it is true that the six leak prosecutions and the insider threat program and all of that has had an effect in chilled sources. I have no doubt that that's true. And I have no doubt, and I'll accept, that every administration is more secretive than the last. But why is that happening? It's happening because the government cannot control the flow of information, of sensitive classified information, pouring out of its walls every day. So this is, in my opinion, a kind of feckless attempt by the government to stop the massive reporting you're doing. So one question, and I think that this that we've become more accepting of these flow of leaks and of your reporting of these leaks. And this is the second, what I consider to be a constitutional change. So why, despite the fact that it's harder for you to get to your sources because of these six leak prosecutions, why does it appear, of course, we don't know the numerator or the denominator, so it's only appeared in terms of percentage of leaks to all classified information. My sense, many people's sense is, I bet your sense is, that there's more stuff coming out, more sensitive stuff, more very highly classified stuff. Three reasons why this is happening, I think. One, just the sheer size of the secrecy bureaucracy. I don't know if it's 1.4 million top security clearances. I think that is 1.4 top secret security clearances and maybe 2.something million clearances altogether. Unbelievable. The number of secrets and the range of secrets and the size of the secrecy bureaucracy makes it very hard for the government to keep secrets, obviously, when their secrets are spread around that broadly. Second reason is technology, of course. The same technology that allows the government to be so successful in collecting information makes it much easier for you and a lot of other people to extract and disperse and publish information. You know, talk about sheer scale. It took Daniel Ellsberg was one page at a time all night long. It took him months and months and months to do the Pentagon Papers. With Snowden and with WikiLeaks, it took, you know, just a few seconds or minutes. Or maybe it took longer than that over time, but the ability to extract quantities, huge quantities of information, has changed in different. It's different in kind now because of technology. The Abu Ghraib story was enabled by technology, digital cameras, JPEG, the internet. Stuff flies around the world now. It's much harder to control once it gets out. There are many more actors who can be involved because of the technology. The secret prison story was uncovered in large part because of, through technological means, through the internet and through sort of coordinated surveillance by citizens and journalists around the globe. So that's a second reason why this stuff is pouring out. And a third reason, and this touches on where we were at the end of our conversation, is I really do think that the norms have changed about what the public is willing to accept from in terms of leaks and in terms of what they're willing to accept in terms of punishing journalists. As Ben, I think it was, said, there's a very clear law, and it's a law that most lawyers think would pass First Amendment scrutiny. It's a law that the New York Times supported when it was promulgated as a good law in the 1950s. 798 of Title 18 is what I think it is. But basically, it very clearly says that the publication of information about surveillance techniques and surveillance capacities is a crime. And it is true that most people in the room have violated this law and, in my opinion, could be criminally punished. The government, I think, could build a case. Nothing in the Pentagon Papers would help you. The government could build a case and bring one against you. But it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't, and I think that its inability to do so has changed in the last 10 years. There was serious conversation when the terror surveillance program leaked about whether journalists should be, the New York Times should be prosecuted. It wasn't just a few people. It was a lot of people. It was a serious discussion. There hasn't been nearly the same kind of discussion now. I think it's, and there are a lot of reasons for that. It has to do with the quantity, which relates to the technology. It has to do with the fact that it's globally dispersed. It has to do with the fact that the people wouldn't support it. As Amy was saying, that there just is no taste for prosecution of the press in this country, for disclosure, even of surveillance techniques. It's in part because the people are upset by what they see, but it's also in part that the norms have changed. Philip is right. He might have gone after the prior restraint, but I don't think any government would authorize a prior restraint of this stuff. It was considered in the Bush administration, I believe. I wasn't privy to that. I wasn't there then, but I've read that it was seriously considered with regard to the terrorist surveillance program. Paul Clement, I read this somewhere, I don't know if it's true, said, won't happen, can't happen. That's even more true today. I think it would be, whether a court would grant one or not, I don't think the executive today, given the globally dispersed nature of this information, once stuff gets out, has the capability of getting prior restraints or prosecuting journalists. And I don't, in part because, and we saw this with the Fox News reporter who was subpoenaed, and the outcry that there was a suggestion in the subpoena that he was had violated the law. The outcry from that, the Attorney General almost resigned, the President apologized for that essentially, and the Department of Justice said, we won't do that again. All of this stuff reflects, I think, importantly changed norms, whether you like it or not. And you folks have much freer rein to publish things than you have before, and your norms have changed. And I have no doubt about this, that the stuff you publish today, you would not have published 20 years ago. Yes, you do the balance. Yes, you talk to the government. Yes, you take it really seriously. I know you do. I know that serious journalistic outfits do. They take very seriously this so-called trade-off between the public's right to know and the public policy goals of disclosure versus the costs of disclosure. But where you draw that line has changed. The surveillance stuff would not have been reported to the same degree 20 years ago. I'm confident of that. I'm sure that you're drawing the lines in different places. There are many reasons for that. In part, the norms have changed. In part, now there's a lot more competition. If the Guardian is reporting stuff, or someone else, if one of your competitors is reporting stuff, then your threshold for reporting, you're in a competitive industry. Personally competitive, journalists compete against each other for scoops, and institutionally competitive, you're going to put your finger on the scale in a different way. All of these forces, I think, have been pushing in the direction of greater and greater disclosure. And I think that they constitute a change in norms, and I would say that it's even a change in our constitutional understandings about what the press is permitted to publish. Now, whether this is a good or bad thing is a complicated question. I tend to think that you serve, on balance, a good role. I think that the Snowden thing is not necessarily an important role in holding the government accountable. If you think about the important changes, I'm almost done. If you think about the important changes in terms of calibrating what the president can and can't do and Congress and the courts pushing back in the last 12 years, every single one of them were made possible by leaks of classified information. Terror surveillance program, the black sites, the stuff of that was going on about interrogation that I think informed the military commission's decision. And I think if it sparked important national debates, I think that there have been costs to this in terms of our national security. I think there's no doubt about that. And I think if you tell yourself a story that there are no costs about your disclosure of these things, and it's all benefit, then with respect, you're deluding yourselves. And I don't think most of you think that. The question is, do the costs justify the benefits? I think it's a very hard question to answer. I think it depends on where you sit. But there's no doubt that there's been a lot on the benefit side. And since I believe that the government is outrageously over-secretive and self-defeatingly over-secretive, and that the government missed errors in making things too secret and in not disclosing more, just because it's self-serving and it has its own mission, I do think you have a vital role in publishing certain forms of classified information when they leak. Now, I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of heat from that from the people, but I do think that. So I guess I'll stop there. The Snowden matter is, it would have been one thing, and I think we could have had a hard debate if he had just disclosed the stuff about domestic surveillance, about the metadata collection and about PRISM. And I think we could have had an interesting a debate about whether he was a traitor or a whistleblower, whether he should have been prosecuted, what the prosecution should look like. I think the disclosure of all of these intelligence secrets about our collection against, including some of our enemies, I think it's very hard to even plausibly tell a whistleblower story about that. At least not from, I'll just leave it. It's very hard to tell a pure whistleblower story about that. So just to sum up, I think that there's been these important shifts, both in terms of the ways, and by the way, the reporting is also an element of accountability of the president. The presidents now have to assume, especially after the NSA disclosure, have to assume that the time frame is going to be shorter and the likelihood greater that something they think they're doing in secret is going to be exposed, and they have to adjust. And that means that they won't do some things they otherwise would have done. That means they're going to be more cautious. Now, it might be good, and that might be bad, depending on what they're going to do, but that is the result of this. So I'll stop there.
Right.
Not to come off as overly sensitive or anything, but I think you leave some holes in the, in your analysis of these things.
Oh, you can disagree.
You credit Congress with ending harsh interrogation. Congress didn't do anything until the press exposed that.
I agree. I said that. I said that you were instrumental in every one of those reforms. I agree.
Technology, you said, has enabled collection, it enables leaks, but it's also enabling prosecution of journalists. I think that's a big factor.
No journalist has been prosecuted.
Well, a prosecution of leaks.
Yes, that's right. But that's a big difference. Those are people who clearly violated the law and their oath to the government.
My question is, it's on your last point when you say that you believe there is excessive secrecy. To me, all the untruths related to Snowden, the biggest whopper is this administration refrain that we welcome this debate. How do you, short of somebody surfacing like Edward Snowden, trigger a debate like this?
I couldn't agree more. I think you cannot, if I wasn't clear enough, this is what I was trying to say. You've performed a vital function in triggering debates that needed to happen. I think about detention, interrogation, especially, about surveillance especially. And I don't think the government would have done it. And I think it should have and would.
Do you think there is a mechanism? Is there a way to construct
there is.
One?
There is a mechanism.
That leads to this debate.
That leads to exactly this debate. And people didn't avail themselves of it. And specifically, Ron Wyden didn't avail himself of it. Wyden spent a few years, right, saying that there's a problem. People would be shocked if they knew how the government was interpreting 215. At any point in there, he could have introduced legislation clarifying what 215 should, in his judgment, say. He could have done it without saying what was going on, but he could have simply introduced a piece of legislation that says, this responds to my perception of the problem that I've described. And I've always been bewildered, actually, he's a very sophisticated, serious guy, and he didn't do it.
But I actually don't think that suffices. I mean, he didn't do it because he didn't want the responsibility for doing it. But I don't think that the government, including the Congress, completes itself. I just don't. I think it is just as you have an institutional interest in putting your thumb on the favor of disclosure for both principled and self-serving reasons, the government, for principled and self-serving reasons, cannot bring itself to disclose what it should disclose. At every point in which someone makes credible argument that we should reveal more about the legal basis for what we're doing. Yes, we'll lose some elements of our ability to collect, but this is an important debate. What we're doing has gotten too far in front of what the law appears to say, and we need to have that debate, and we're going to be better off in the long run if we have that debate. That kind of argument can never get traction in the government. Only the press, in my opinion, can spark that kind of argument, and I think you have. With lots of errors and mistakes, just like the government makes, but you've done the very hugely valuable service. I agree.
Steve.
My question is, and maybe Ben wants to address this as well, is do you think when Congress approved Section 215 that it had any idea it was authorizing metadata collection?
In 2008 or 2012?
2001, I think.
2001 is when it was first.
No.
Well, if not, then...
I'm not sure what your question is, sorry.
Why didn't the Bush administration make the case for why it needed that authority instead of pushing through a provision very aggressively interpreting it in a way that even Sensenbrenner said was excessive?
Listen, I believe it should have, and I've written books about that. And it would have been a lot better off if it had. And I think it could have easily back then.
Given what you said, given that you said Snowden was both, did a public service and did a bad thing, what would be the appropriate way to inform the public and, to be honest, a lot of Congress about the way the law has been interpreted, you know, and it may not even be legal.
Are you talking about in 2001 or now? It's a much different institutional world now. Hugely different.
Well, you can address it as it's evolved.
So how can the public... I believe that there's more room for disclosure about legal interpretation of these authorities. The 702, the PRISM, the content collection against foreigners with incidental collection for U.S. citizens, as Ben has written, there was nothing surprising about that. We had that debate pretty openly about in 2008 and 2012. What it turned out the government was doing was exactly what the critics of the law said it was going to do. It was explicit, Congress approved it, and the government did what basically we thought. And then we've gotten a lot of details about what was going on in terms of what the minimization procedures are, what the targeting procedures are, what the FISA court's role was, how it was pushing back and not. The metadata collection, there was a larger gap between the public expectation and the law. And my basic view is that with regard to domestic collection, the government needs to and can, I think one of the things we've learned from this episode, should disclose more about the legal basis for its collection in the homeland and then the basic scope of the collection. And there would have been costs to the collection, there's no doubt about it. I think the costs would be much greater now than they would have been had we had the debate more openly. But I think that that's a trade-off that the government needs to get used to. There needs to be, and there will be, and there has been, a recalibration of how much transparency the National Security Agency and is willing to accept for sort of longer-term strategic legitimacy. I think that will be the rule going forward, in my opinion.
Ben?
So I agree that there's a larger gap with respect to 215 collection than there is with respect to 702 collection, where there really is none. But I don't think it's right to say that the gap is much smaller with respect to Congress than it is with respect to the public.
After 2012.
After 2010.
10, I mean, yeah, that's right.
You know, and there was when this stuff came up for reauthorization in 2010, this is, you know, I think part of the administration's sense of being burned on this, which I'm sympathetic to, frankly. There was a judgment made that, and it's reflected in some of the correspondence with Congress, that the administration really did not want members voting on this program, on 215 reauthorization, without knowing what they were voting for. And the result is a series of letters and a report that was sent to both intelligence committees with a specific request that they be made available not merely to the members of the intelligence committees, but to all members of both bodies. That happened both in 2010 and 2011. And in 2010, both committees honored that request. In 2011, the House Intelligence Committee kind of screwed up and did not make that material available as widely as it should have. But there's a, you know, there are a lot of members of Congress who did not avail themselves of opportunities they had to know what was going on. And there are some members of Congress, particularly, you know, I think it's fair to pick on James Sensenbrenner, who have been, you know, who have been remarkable in their willingness to say things, including in, you know, formal statements that are just not quite true about what was represented to them in real time starting in 2009.
Harry.
I appreciate your comments. I wonder if you think, in light of your remarks, whether the U.S. government has an obligation of some sort, legal, the fact that we live in a democracy, something less than legal, to disclose when it has targeted people for killing and it has killed the wrong people. Because to date, the one comment we have on that is a thinly sourced, no fault of the New York Times, but an anonymous statement to the New York Times that a 16-year-old kid was killed as a result of what appears to be a mistake.
I would need to have a lot more information before I can answer that question. Was it a covert action? If it were covert action and we had given assurance to the foreign government, I would say they can't do it and they shouldn't. We're in war. A lot of people get killed, including innocent people. It's what war is about. There's never been a duty to disclose every person that you mistakenly killed. In fact, it actually gets reported pretty robustly now, thanks to you. So you're doing the stuff that you think the government should be doing. And I just think it's a hard question, a very hard question, because there are serious costs to the government for doing that. There are going to be mistakes and civilian casualties and more.
But there are certain international law obligations, according to a couple of reports this week from Egypt.
Which international laws?
Well, obligations at least to pay the families of...
Which international laws? I don't think there are any such international laws. Maybe there's a moral obligation. We have, in fact, several programs. I know we did in Afghanistan. I don't know how robust they were. We're paying when we made mistakes. And I think I'm all for that. I think it's a great idea to the extent we can do it. I think that the government should own up to its mistakes to the extent it can. But it's very complicated. And in fact, the government's mistakes are much more known now, thanks to you, than they ever have been anywhere. There's no doubt about that.
Well, Jack, you talk about the war framework, but isn't it the case that a lot of other countries in the UN, for example, don't agree with that law of war theory for strikes, particularly outside the Fatah in Afghanistan?
Yes, it is the case, but it's also the case that the Congress, the Supreme Court, and two presidents in this country think the war framework is appropriate. And so we've got an international disagreement. But in terms of domestic legitimacy, there's simply no question at all. It's just not, it's rock solid.
What are the implications of the international? Even our allies, even the British, it seems like, don't completely buy our reason.
So there's a lot of self-servingness on both sides of the legal interpretation. The implications are there's been big pushback against the drone program. Orchestrated, global, public, and private campaign against against targeting, and there's been a pushback against it. And it's narrow for that reason, because it was becoming a strategic liability. So I think that push has been somewhat successful.
Jamie has a little something to add, and then we'll go to Spencer.
No, you're on the list for questions.
Good. Spencer, then I got you, Jamie.
So one comment and then a kind of sort of big question to see whoever wants to take it, particularly you. But first, whatever anyone wants to think about the robustness of those internal checks, one of the reasons that those internal checks on surveillance exist is you, so thanks. You may not have wanted to say that, but okay. And then on a kind of big sort of blue sky question, I want to see if there's any appetite for it. It seems one of the persistent, at least somewhat normative disagreements that exist around the legitimacy of Congress and the court's oversight of these programs is the degree to which the framework for that institutionally over the past 35 years has kind of run aground or run its course. It's very notable that the chairs of the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees are robustly behind these programs, and those on the Judiciary Committees who are not as fulsomely briefed and rather, I'll leave it there, not as fulsomely briefed for maximum consensus around the terms, are not and are really up in arms over it. And the same thing as, now, really, thanks to reporting, the public has much more of an understanding of how the FISA court works and is kind of shocked by it. And I wonder if, accordingly, it's time to... when we talk about the robust oversight of the FISA court, I'm getting there. I'm wondering if perhaps it's time to think about what a new structure from a court perspective and from a congressional perspective might look like if lots of people of good faith can look at these structures right now and say there's something that just seems so weighted towards the idea of capture, that the committees are captured, that a court that only hears from one petitioner is not a reasonable check on surveillance, as you might expect, but is just another box that the government must check on a surveillance process. Yeah. And I put that out for anyone who might want to take that up.
So I have no doubt that there will be some reforms in terms of, and it'll be along the lines that we've been moving for the last 10 years. There will be more robust judicial review. There will probably be some kind of adversarial process introduced. There probably be assurances of more balance on the court. First of all, I'm not sure that to the extent to which you say the public understands what FISA is doing and is against it. Again, I predict that something like this basic structure, when it actually comes time to take a real vote as opposed to the fake vote the House of Representatives had, and when the votes actually matter, and when the president actually makes the case because he knows that the program being eliminated is on the line, I predict that this stuff will be continued largely within the same framework, because I think the framework is actually pretty decent. I think it will be tweaked largely for superficial reasons. I don't think that these instances are captured. The reason you think that they're captured is because you don't like the results they're giving. You don't think they're pushing back enough.
I don't think that's a reason.
Let me finish, please. I think, how do you measure whether they're captured or not? It's hard to measure for any context because they agree, they disagree, they push back a little bit. Maybe they should push back more. I don't think the FISA court is captured at all. I think they've been very robust in their review of the executive branch based on the document. But if you think, if the people, this is a question of democratic choice. It's now out in the open. The president will make the case. The critics will make the case. The Congress will vote. And these are all trade-offs that we can all disagree about, and that's what democracy sorts out. And now it will be done in public, thanks to you folks. And I predict that the programs will largely be continued.
Little, Steve? A little?
I'll try to make it a little. I mean, agencies that operate in public in full light of day get captured all the time. Why? I mean, I think it's natural to assume that anything agency is going to be captured, particularly one that operates in secret.
You think journalists are captured by their sources?
Very often.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we change beats every
Great.
Several years.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay.
Well, hang on a second, because there's a laboratory experiment about capture that's going on right now. It's called the House versus the Senate. Right? You said because you change beats. Well, in the House, there are term limits to serving on the Intelligence Committee. In the Senate, there aren't. So in the House, they have to roll off, right? They have to change beats. In the Senate, they don't, but yet you see the same result, which suggests that they're not being captured, that what's going on is maybe they're more informed or something else is going on.
I don't want to deny that there's not an element of capture. I think any regulating agency that's close to the regulated entity, there's always that threat. To some extent, it's definitely true. And frankly, most of the people I know in the intelligence community love to report because they think it gives them kind of comfort. They can spread the responsibility. It's a difficult problem. I mean, maybe reforms like that can be introduced. I just don't think we can assume they're captured just by looking at what's happening. And I look at what's happened in secret, not in public, in secret. And everyone thought this stuff wouldn't come out, and there's actually been, you know, a decent amount of pushback along every one of these dimensions, every one of these programs. And so, you know, we can introduce, all these things involve trade-offs, and I think the country will decide, do we want more transparency? Do we want to, you can't have an intelligence program. You cannot have an intelligence program and have everything debated in public. So we're going to have more transparency. We have to figure out how much we're willing to accept and what trade-off. And maybe publicity will eliminate what you think is captured. What cost will that come and how important are each of those things? These are all things that the democracy will decide. And I don't think there's any other way to look at it. And we all have different views about this. And I predict that it will largely be renewed, largely on the terms that it is now. And it will be, thanks to you, much more legitimate.
I wanted to raise one thing about Snowden that hasn't been noted, and this has something to do with what you said about the leaked prosecutions. You were fairly dismissive about this. I think it's fair to say that there's a very good chance that Edward Snowden would not exist if it weren't for Manning and Drake. By his own account, he saw these guys as heroes who were going doing an and run around the system to get the truth out about the abuses they saw. I actually think that the series of unprecedented leak prosecutions backfired and actually produced Snowden. So you've had a kind of escalation on both sides. And I think the distressing thing about the leak prosecutions is they really were never decided on by Obama, by Holder. It's sort of a it was a radical change of policy. For decades, you'd had this sort of balance where, we would write stuff that was classified and occasionally the FBI would go around to your sources and, scare the hell out of them. But there was this sort of truce. And then suddenly you have the whole series of leak prosecutions, some almost completely bogus. And Ben mentioned that there are ways to... Well, I mean, let's take Tom Drake. I mean, Ben mentioned that there are ways to do this. He went to the IG, he went to Congress, and he had a very, very good case. I think anyone looks at actually what happened historically and what his complaints were. And even the judge who ended up sentencing him to community service was furious at the prosecution. So there are these kind of ham-handed, unprecedented prosecutions, and they actually created Edward Snowden. So I would say that there really is a breakdown in the, I mean, I agree with you that, that you have these contesting forces, but I think there's a bit of a breakdown in the systems that were set up democratically. So if you look at the church committee and compare it to today's Senate Intelligence Committee, the only press conference that I'm aware of that the House and Senate committees held together in recent years was to denounce leaks. They have largely become not the, you know, watchdog over the agencies, but the guard dog of the agencies. And when you have the Director of National Intelligence, in his view, in his words, saying the least untruthful thing he can say in an open congressional hearing, I think there's just been a breakdown in the mechanisms that were created to allow the flow of some classified information out to the public.
Which mechanisms are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the intelligence committees, and I'm talking about the leak prosecutions that deters leaks that would otherwise be quite salient. And I think Snowden is a result.
So first of all, on that point, that is certainly that you wouldn't report that. That's far too broad a prosecution. I mean, there may have been a lot of things that led Snowden to do what he did, but I'm quite sure we don't have an information that he did what he did because of what happened.
Well, he said that.
I understand that he said it. He says lots of things. We say a lot of things about it. Right. But clearly, there are a lot of other things going on. What would you have the government do? The government is in a position where it can't. I don't know the details of all the prosecutions. I don't know the extent to which all of them were prudent. I don't buy this idea that Holder and Obama didn't know what was going on. They could have at any moment read the papers. It seems what's going on and put a stop.
But they never decided actively, we're going to have a whole new policy here. Yeah. And here's
that's. But they allowed it to happen. And so I guess I can't debate the merits of the individual prosecution. I think, on the whole, their response to the fact that there's been massive change in the nature of the government is somewhat in a panic about that, and I think this was maybe a ham-handed, in some of the cases, attempt to control that. But what would you have the government do? The government can't sit on its hands. People violate the law and their oaths and reveal what the government deems to be very important and harmful information when released. If you're in the government, you just can't take a passive attitude.
Well, they did for decades.
But things have changed because the leaks are much more expensive than they've ever been before. I think this is just a reaction to more leaks. I can't defend the individuals. I don't know the details of most of them. And I think it's as much accident as systematic, as you were saying. And maybe it was stupid for Holder not to get control of them, better control over them. But when you criticize these leak investigations, So do you think, is it your view that whenever someone discloses classified information, they should never be prosecuted?
No, but you pointed out, I mean, you know, let's put it this way.
Seriously, but what do you think?
No, I think in general we got along quite well with many leaks of classified information, many publications of classified information. People were reprimanded and sometimes put on leave and various kinds of administrative penalties. But then there was this huge escalation. You pointed out that 798 under the Espionage Act, you could put us all in prison, but there's a decision not to.
Yeah, I agree.
And what I'm saying is that there's been a breakdown here between the leak investigations, and I really do think that they made a big contribution to creating Edward Snowden.
But then the government made a huge strategic mistake.
That's true.
You guys jump in if you have thoughts. I just want to press on one thing. What is it your position that the government should never prosecute people who leak classified information?
No, that's not my position.
Well, I'd like to find out just then when can the government prosecute a leaker?
This is a hard, you're going to have a hard time drawing this.
Yeah, I think it's a policy question, not a legal question. As Jack pointed out, we could all be in prison now, but there's been a policy decision not to pursue that course. And I'm saying the policy decision to prosecute all these leakers was a big mistake.
Yeah, I understand that. But if the Attorney General said, we're drawing in some compulsory guidelines for discretion, we've got the statute here. Statute looks like we can prosecute everybody. You agree we should prosecute somebody. What are the parameters of that prosecution? What would it be?
Prosecute leakers to the New York Times.
There you go. Thank you. Composed.
I would have a very, very, very high bar.
Yeah.
But like what?
Edward Snowden would be a good start because.
Would you capture Snowden, for example? in that bar?
I don't know. I mean, I think in you know, like a paper like the New York Times and all the rest of us, really, we're feeding off of Snowden's leaks. We've contributed to this debate that the President of the United States welcomed and thinks is a great thing. So I think there is there's a lot of competing interests here. And to treat Snowden as a terrible, terrible thing.
No, unmixed evil. If you can't prosecute Snowden.
That's not what he said. He did good, but shouldn't he be prosecuted?
Who would you prosecute?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not, that's not my job. My job is you know, my role here is, as Jack pointed out, is in the direction of transparency. I'm all for leaks. So it's not really my job to be a prosecutor of leaks. As a citizen, I recognize that there might be some circumstances, even in the United States, where you might want to prosecute a leaker, but I lived in the Soviet Union for several years, and I've seen what it looks like when the government is the last word on what's secret and what's not secret. It doesn't work so well.
Why should
that doesn't happen here?
It doesn't happen here at all, even with leak prosecution.
It really doesn't happen here. That's never happened here, nor in the United Kingdom.
Right.
Can I, having interrupted, can I continue my interruption? It's on this whole thing, yes.
Spencer had one also.
Yeah, okay, Spencer can go first.
It just strikes me that when what you're outlining, Jack, is a system in which more and more U.S. policy is determined in secret, more is kept secret, and more leaks out for us because we end up being the only valve and a de facto part of the system of correction and accountability, then the greater the pressures will grow for a subsequent administration to fire the gun that you have left on the table. And in terms of this, you might not believe that this will ever happen, but a lot of us here really have an equity in recognizing, you know, what happens,
Spencer,
when that happens. I don't. You may be normatively right.
You're sitting here and are not being arrested.
How long, Jack?
Believe me, they wouldn't have, if they wanted to arrest you, they wouldn't have waited any longer than they've waited. The fact that you're not being arrested for the most extraordinary and extravagant and harmful national security technical election leaks ever suggests to me that the norm has fundamentally changed. But that's all I can say. I can't promise you it's never going to happen. The law's still in the books. But I suspect you wouldn't be here if you thought there were any chance of you being. And I think that's, you know, I imagine that you had some legal advice, and I'm pretty sure the lawyers told you it was a very low risk, and I think they're accurate. And I think that this is the point I was trying to make. We're living through a period where it's clearer than ever that the government cannot and will not prosecute journalists for violating clear laws that First Amendment scholars think come closest to being able to surpass First Amendment scrutiny.
There's a little bit of history. I've got to jump in. Those of us who have been subpoenaed and found in contempt, everybody's forgetting what went on in the Bush administration. When the New York Times was very upset about the leak of Valerie Plame's name and suggested there should be prosecution.
Editorial page.
The liberal part of it. And a whole bunch of us got caught up in it. But it is a responsibility we have. I mean, we're like every other citizen. And that's always been my fight about the press in general, the idea that nobody can subpoena us. We move to quash it rather than say, okay, I'm like other citizens, and I'll go to the grand jury, and I won't testify. And I'll put myself in the same kind of jeopardy my sources.
Yeah.
That, to me, is what the press standards should be. And the second part, which I really have to get out about the Snowden thing, mainly because, one, the story about 215 came out in 2008 on the front page of USA Today, and nobody wrote about it.
There were no documents.
Well, it made it better. But the second part of it is, when it did come out, what everybody calls this, I hate the narrative, the story is, because of 215, the government knows where you are, who you visited, who you talked to, where your doctor is, all the rest of it. And people in public life did it, and we repeated it. That just wasn't true. when you talk about the other disclosures, the Dana Priest story, there were people who were involved. The waterboarding, there were names involved. There's not been one case, and Tom Drake has nothing to do with it. Tom Drake was spending money. It was not misuse of NSA data. There's not been, as far as I know, one case of somebody misusing data for their own personal reason or for violating anybody's civil liberty.
Love it.
When you're looking up your ex-girlfriend.
There were a couple of cases where people were abusing it, and they were caught. And so 10 cases over how many years, the government, someone abusing their authority, the numbers seem extremely tiny to me.
Can I add a few words from London? I think that this whole discussion is absolutely fascinating and is actually a great tribute to the various branches of the United States and these first, second, third, and fourth estates of the United States. And I think in a way there's been an elephant in the room all day today until Jack mentioned that this is really an unprecedented kind of war. And the enemy is morphing all the time. And it's very, very hard for any government to defend its citizens in this war. We are facing an enemy that is implacable, that cannot be bought off, that has one target of, in the end, the Al-Qaeda has the target of imposing Sharia law and killing as many people as it wishes and can around the world in order to do that, in small places or in large. And tens of thousands, scores of thousands of people are dying every year, mostly Muslims, killed by Al-Qaeda and its associates. In Europe, we have a growing problem about this. We have, according to the British government, there are about 200 British Muslims now fighting in Syria, and they're coming back as veterans and anxious, not all of them, but many of them, to do Al-Qaeda-linked damage in Britain itself. Two Syrian veterans from Syria were arrested in the last 10 days in London. It's a very, very difficult situation, and it's going to go on for a very long time. And I think the United States should be held up as an example, actually, as how of the restraint in which it has dealt with this horror that we all face. And it isn't going to go away. And this sort of discussion contributes, I think, to all of our understanding of it. And I'm very grateful to be here. But it's vile, and it's a problem for all governments and press all over the world to try and deal with it in the most responsible and way possible. It's very difficult, and we will make it.
Ken or Jack, please give us a final.
I don't have any profound final thoughts. Thank you all for coming. You're some of the smartest people I know in the national security world, and I just think that you should. Just consider that you're an institution like the institutions you cover. Think that through deeply. That's what I urge you to do.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.